This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 29th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's program, the House of Representatives releases its version of healthcare reform legislation.
The real crux of this fight, where the insurance companies fought us tooth and nail, was a robust public option, and they won.
Obama signs a law that will change rules for military commissions used to try Guantanamo Bay detainees.
Now, as President Obama's military commissions, you know, he owns them, he owns all the problems that will come with them. Their, I think, inevitable failure is going to scar his legacy.
And we'll go to Gaza, where reconstruction efforts have yet to start, 10 months after the Israeli military offensive. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. economy is growing again. This according to figures released today by the Commerce Department.
In the third quarter of this year, the economy grew at an annual rate of 3.5%, the first time we've seen positive growth in a year, the strongest growth in 2 years.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner spoke before the House Financial Services Committee. The Department of Commerce says the recovery can be partly attributed to the increase in spending on cars and trucks. The Financial Services Committee today looked at a plan to overhaul regulation of the financial industry. The proposal would give the government a framework to manage the so-called too-big-to-fail companies. Again, Secretary Geithner.
If the government is exposed to loss when it acts to protect the system, any risk of loss, it should assess a fee on banks over time to recoup that loss. That's to make sure the taxpayer is not in a position of absorbing those losses.
FDIC Chair Sheila Blair says the plan doesn't go far enough and should require high-risk firms to pay in advance. Iran today issued its response to a proposal that would require the country to ship much of its nuclear material abroad for processing in Russia and France. The plan aims to alleviate concerns that Iran will use the material to make a nuclear weapon. According to initial reports in Iran's state media, the country has accepted parts of the draft agreement, but says it will not meet the demand of handing over the bulk of its nuclear material by the end of the year. Instead, it says it will ship the material in small quantities. The officials of the Afghan Independent Election Commission said today that the process of delivering the ballot boxes and other logistical support has been completed ahead of the anticipated runoff elections, but not all Afghan citizens will get their chance to go to the polls. FSRN's Kabul-based reporter Mujahid Jawad reports.
On November 7th, voters in Afghanistan will head to the polls for a runoff election between incumbent President Hamid Karzai and his main challenger Abdullah Abdullah. But Independent Election Commission official Zikria Barakzai told reporters security and weather issues will limit the number of polling centers that can open. He says polls in 11 districts will not open. Those districts are predominantly in provinces in the eastern part of the country, along the border with Pakistan. The Afghan Ministry of Defense already announced that elections would not be possible in districts with no government security forces. But the government assures that security will be tight at the polling stations that do open. Officials say more than 300,000 domestic and international troops will be deployed. Mujahid Jawad, FSRN, Kabul.
Several hunger strikers in Guinea have been arrested for their protests, marking yesterday's one-month anniversary of the deadly crackdown on protesters by the military government. The West African nation was in turmoil a month ago. Soldiers opened fire on a crowd and killed more than 150 people. Widespread and blatant cases of rape have also been documented. 10,000 people went on strike to mark the anniversary. Today, the State Department announced it has imposed travel restrictions on members of the military junta, saying it has shown itself to be incapable of handling the country's transition into democracy. Voting machine company Sequoia announced they will reveal the source code for their voting machines. Source code is kind of like the recipe or blueprint of how a computer system works. This is a step that's long been called for by voting transparency advocates. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer has more.
Sequoia, whose voting machines are used in 16 states and the District of Columbia, says source code for their new optical scan voting machines will be released to the public in November of 2010, once it's federally certified and tested. Sequoia's announcement comes less than a week after a group called the Open Source Digital Voting Foundation began releasing their source code for a prototype election system they're developing. Gregory Miller is co-executive director of the Open Source Digital Voting Foundation. He says public ownership is a key to making elections truly participatory and reducing the cost, likely not the goal of for-profit Sequoia.
What they are doing is disclosing their source. That's saying they're putting it on display for people to inspect. That does not mean that they're going to allow anyone to modify it, change it, or build a new system based upon it, or that they're going to have any collaborative effort that involves the community in improving that system.
There have been numerous problems documented with Sequoia's optical scan machine since 2002, including votes failing to register for the right candidates and failure to count votes at all. Andrew Stelzer, Free Speech Radio News.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The House of Representatives released its version of health care reform legislation. The bill, reading nearly 2,000 pages, includes a public option and is expected to be deficit neutral. Its introduction was hailed by proponents in Washington as historic, but some Democrats, including many progressives, are disappointed. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The new health care reform bill in the House is the product merged from three different bills. House Democrats gathered to debut the legislation with the Capitol towering in the background. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called it historic.
It is with great pride and with great humility that we come before you to follow in the footsteps of those who gave our country Social Security and then Medicare and now universal quality affordable health care for all Americans.
Even though Speaker Pelosi called it universal, about 11 million people are expected to remain uninsured. This new version includes a public option, and it mandates people to buy insurance and mandates employers to provide it for those whose businesses are worth more than $500,000. It also expands Medicaid eligibility to 150% of poverty, or an income of $33,000 for a family of four. The legislation also closes the insurance industry's antitrust exemption and allows people to stay on their parents' insurance until 27 years of age. It also prohibits exclusion of coverage due to pre-existing conditions. Some of the nearly $900 billion bill will be paid for by a surtax on couples making more than $1 million per year. Republicans responded in opposition immediately. Representative Mike Pence of Indiana says the Democrats aren't listening to public opinion.
Saying they want health care reform that lowers the cost of health insurance. They want health care reform that lowers the cost of health care. But they didn't want government-run insurance paid for with hundreds of billions of dollars of higher taxes and mandates. But that's exactly what they've gotten.
Democratic leadership crafted a bill they thought would pass the House, attempting to appeal to both moderate and liberal Democrats who are in disagreement on how to conduct health care reform. Unable to secure a majority of votes for a robust public option, Democrats offered a scaled-back version. At least one moderate Democrat, Earl Pomeroy of North Dakota, is pleased. The more limited public option debuted ties doctor reimbursement rates to the market.
Look, this was such a core issue to me and others that we were unmovable until we got to fair payment under a public option through negotiated rate. Once that was resolved, we're for it.
But proponents of a robust public option, which would tie reimbursement rates to Medicare, say the robust option is the only way to truly lower the cost of health insurance because it slices through inflated pricing. Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona and co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus says he's disappointed. He said the leadership gave in to moderate Democrats.
But the real crux of this fight, where the insurance companies fought us tooth and nail, was a robust public option, and they won. To some extent, they won that part of it.
Progressive members of Congress have a meeting at the White House Thursday. Grijalva says he expects the president to attempt to win his support. But the support of progressives might be difficult to obtain. Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio was livid when he found out that his provision was pulled out of the bill. It would have allowed states to implement a single-payer system.
Unless I hear otherwise, I can only assume that the insurance company interest brought pressure to take it out. Otherwise, I would have heard from someone. No one gave me any rational reason as to why that should be done.
Progressives say the fight is not over, and they will continue to work to change the bill. And it's not too late to do so because some things still have to be worked out, including language on abortion. Democrats hope the bill is ready to come to the floor by the end of next week. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The military commissions used to try Guantanamo detainees will come under new rules. The Military Commissions Act of 2009 is part of the defense bill that President Obama signed on Wednesday. The rules will bring the commissions more into line with international law by granting defendants the right to attend their own trial and examine the evidence against them. The new rules also exclude statements obtained through torture from the proceedings. Those are important changes, says Shaina Kadidal, the senior managing attorney of the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. The CCR brought the first habeas corpus case to Supreme Court and oversees more than 200 cases of Guantanamo detainees. Attorney Shaina Kadidal says keeping the military commissions as an option represents a compromise from Obama, not a clear break from the Bush era.
The difference now is that they're President Obama's military commissions. You know, he owns them. He owns all the problems that will come with them. If they're used, their inevitable failure is going to scar his legacy.
Kadidal says there is a judicial system already in place that would be more appropriate.
Terrorism is a particularly destructive and heinous sort of form of crime, and it has to be treated using the criminal justice system, which is perfectly capable of trying terrorists, as we've seen with the 93 World Trade Center bombing and the East Africa embassy bombings, perfectly capable of handling classified information and evidence, and it has much greater legitimacy than any military trial system.
The new rules still permit the prosecution of children at military trials. Human rights groups had pushed for a prohibition on the practice. There are about 220 detainees at Guantanamo. President Obama has pledged to close the prison camp in January 2010. Next week, Maine voters will decide if a law that guarantees the right of same-sex couples to get married will stay on the books. Earlier this year, Maine became the fifth state to approve same-sex marriage when Governor John Baldacci signed LD 1020. But soon after, anti-gay marriage groups petitioned for a referendum on the law, and it goes before voters on Tuesday. Here to join us is Jesse Connolly. He's the campaign manager for the No on One campaign. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
So to be clear, a no vote on the referendum next week means what?
A no vote means that we are rejecting the people's veto that is in front of the voters that would take away the law that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor to bring full equality to all Maine same-sex couples. The Maine legislature was the first legislature in the country to pass this pass a marriage equality bill and then have it signed by a sitting governor. When the legislature and the governor did this in earlier this past May. But Maine also has a provision in its state constitution that allows for what's called a people's veto, where citizens can collect signatures to force an up or down vote on the law. And right now the law has not gone into effect pending the outcome of this vote.
In May, Governor Baldacci signed LD 1020 into law. He had previously been against same-sex marriage. What encouraged him to sign the law, and then what got this referendum on the ballot?
Sure. Well, Governor Baldacci, I think, talked to a lot of Maine citizens, looked at the debate that happened in the committee, talked to supporters and opponents of LD 1020, and really came to the assumption, or the conclusion, rather, that Maine same-sex couples were denied many protections that my wife and I enjoy as a married heterosexual couple, and he was, really proud to be the first governor in the nation to sign a marriage equality bill into law, and he's been a great supporter for us since the law has been signed, and now we're in this referendum stage.
One primary charge by groups like Stand for Marriage Maine, which is one of the groups that got the referendum on the ballot, has been that the law would change curriculum in schools, would it?
This law, this campaign, this bill has nothing to do with schools. This is a scare tactic that our opposition has used to essentially say that the passage of this law, the success of this referendum, will allow school curriculums to start teaching homosexual marriage, as they put it, in the classroom. This has nothing to do with schools. This has nothing to do with curriculum. Here in Maine, our curriculum is developed at a two-step process. There are guidelines put forth by the state, and then all curriculum decisions are made at the local school board level. So the passage of this law would have nothing to do with what kids are taught in school.
As we know, in California, Proposition 8 passed last year. That's the proposition which overturned a state Supreme Court decision that said same-sex couples had the constitutional right to marriage. How does this fight in Maine fit into the national effort to legalize gay marriage?
Well, you know, we're really very focused on what's happening up here in our state. We're up in the sort of northeast corner of the world and surrounded by some other states, New Hampshire and Vermont and Massachusetts and Connecticut, that have legalized same-sex marriage. And, you know, we feel really good about where our state is, what our state is doing. So we're just really focused on what's happening here in Maine, and whatever may or may not happen afterwards, we'll let that play itself out. But we're just really focused on the effort here on the ground in our state.
And finally, what do same-sex couples stand to lose if this referendum does go through next week?
Well, if we're, you know, if this referendum is passed, same-sex couples are really stand to lose a lot of the legal protections that come with marriage here in our state. You know, things like inheritance rights and health insurance and other legal protections. You know, really are what we're all about, and I think this is really you know, coming down to going to be a very close vote. We're expecting, you know, a lot of folks to come and turn out, and really you know, just excited about where this campaign is and what we have left to do in the next 4 to 5 days.
We've been speaking with Jesse Connolly. He's the campaign manager for the No on One campaign that aims to defeat a referendum in Maine next week that threatens same-sex marriage in the state. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Voters in Virginia will head to the polls next Tuesday to elect their new governor. The race is between Republican Bob McDonnell, the state's former attorney general, and Democrat Creed Deeds, a state legislator since 1991 and former county prosecutor. As one of two states electing a governor this year, some political analysts are watching closely to see what the results might mean for future elections. From WRIR in Richmond, Brad Kuttner reports.
A former rivalry rehashes itself next Tuesday. The last time Bob McDonnell and Cree Deeds went toe-to-toe, it was over the office of Virginia's Attorney General. McDonnell beat Deeds by a narrow 323 votes out of nearly 2 million votes cast. This year is delivering another heated race, with McDonnell leading in the polls, sometimes by double digits. McDonnell was endorsed by the Richmond Times-Dispatch and the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. However, Deeds won an endorsement from the Washington Post, as well as the backing of the Virginian Pilot, McDonnell's hometown newspaper. President Obama is also campaigning for Deeds. He appears in a new TV ad and flew to Virginia Tuesday for a campaign rally at Old Dominion University in Norfolk. The president told a crowd of more than 5,000 that Deeds has the intuition to lead and the willingness to work across party lines.
You'll have the chance to elect somebody who is cut from the very same cloth as Tim Kaine and Mark Warner. Somebody who listens to folks even when we don't always agree. Somebody who focuses not on short-term politics, but on a practical, long-term vision. And that man is Creed Deeds.
Former presidential candidate John McCain has stumped for McDonnell on several occasions, including at a VFW hall in Virginia Beach earlier this month. Since the campaigns began, both Deeds and McDonnell have focused on economic issues rather than social ones. Both candidates pledged to create new jobs for Virginia by expanding grants, tax credits, and job training. On social issues, Deeds and McDonnell have some traditional party line differences. As a state lawmaker, McDonnell voted to restrict access to abortions and to the so-called morning after pill. Deeds advocates reproductive choice. Speaking on the 700 Club in 2006, McDonnell said same-sex marriage was straining the bonds of traditional marriage.
From the Garden of Eden to 2006, we believed that marriage is between a man and a woman, but because of some social trends out there and some court decisions, Pat, as you know, marriage is under attack.
But on some social issues, the candidates have more common ground. Both candidates support the death penalty. Both have supported the expansion of the trigger man rule, which allows conspirators to receive the death penalty. As the campaigns make a final push before Tuesday, Virginia voters are weighing their choices. Marcia Penn, a consultant from Richmond, says she's voting for Deeds because he appeals to her values.
I think he's more interested in the common man, and I'd like someone who cares about diversity, and I think he does.
But other voters have their eye on McDonnell, including Kevin Madre, a server from Richmond.
I'd vote McDonnell because I think he agrees with my family values.
Healthcare and the environment are also concerns, especially for Mike McKenzie, a graduate student at VCU in Richmond.
Climate change, I think, might be the most important one that should be addressed as soon as possible, even if that's not politically feasible. I think it's important to start to work on immediately.
Some election observers anticipate low voter turnout, which is typical in this off-year election. This could work against Deeds, who some say needs to draw the support of young and black voters who traditionally vote Democratic. Carrie Funk is director of the Commonwealth Poll at Virginia Commonwealth University.
It's an ongoing issue in America that not enough people vote, and the number of people who are voting has gone down over time. What happened in 2008 in the presidential election was so surprising because people were so excited and motivated about the election. And you kind of had that feeling like maybe it would continue, but it doesn't look like it has so far.
Republicans have invested heavily in this campaign, helping to raise more than $17 million for McDonnell, about $4 million more than Deeds. Conservatives are hoping a win could be seen as a bellwether for the 2010 elections. Dan Palazzola is a professor at the University of Richmond.
Some people will certainly view the election as a mini referendum on the president, particularly after a big election like 2008. And so I do think it has some national implications, and that explains in part why national figures come in and campaign so heavily and money comes in from out of state for the campaign.
Virginians go to the polls November 3rd. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
For nearly a decade, FSRN has brought you news from more than 200 reporters across six continents. At a time when newspapers are downsizing and closing their international bureaus, FSRN continues to bring you on-the-ground and in-depth coverage from global hotspots like the Gaza Strip and the Tribal Belt of Pakistan. Your support of FSRN goes a long way in building and strengthening our international coverage. Visit FSRN.org to learn more about how you can help. In Gaza, the Hamas government warned residents against voting in the January 2010 elections called by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of the rival Fatah party. Hamas and Fatah have been locked in a bitter and sometimes deadly power struggle since 2007, despite attempts to form a lasting unity deal. Meanwhile, reconstruction efforts in Gaza have yet to start, 10 months after a major Israeli military offensive last winter. Israel's blockade of the coastal territory, along with an internationally enforced embargo against the ruling Hamas party, are causing the largest delays. FSRN's Rami Almagari has the story.
Reconstruction of Gaza faces many hurdles. One of them is the Israeli blockade that has sealed off the borders since June 2007. Azam Salim, once a leading building contractor in Gaza, lost his livelihood because the blockade prevents many building materials from entering Gaza.
If we ask an engineer to design a building, the top priorities for us are cement and iron. Then we still need wood, aluminum, kitchen infrastructure materials, and others. But our first priorities are cement and iron.
Salim hoped that the billions of dollars pledged for reconstruction would put him back to work. But he is still waiting, spending hours each day with other jobless friends on the main road that runs through the Gaza Strip. He sits just steps from a bakery he helped build a few years ago. The January attacks left tens of thousands of homes, shops, universities, mosques, and ministerial buildings either partially or completely destroyed. An estimated 40,000 residents are still homeless, many living in tents. Mahmoud Abul Anzin is a resident of the northern Jabalia refugee camp. He and his children stay in one of those tents.
I used to live happily with my kids in the home. Now we live in a tent where even the animal cannot live. You see how unbearable this tent is? We appeal for help.
Another scene of destruction remains at several universities. The Islamic University of Gaza lost a major scientific laboratory due to bombing from Israeli warplanes. The laboratory serves the university as well as other sectors in the Gaza community. Dr. Kamalin Shaat is a president of the Islamic University of Gaza.
There used to be laboratories for poisonous substances and genetic tests that the public used to benefit from. Yet we're not able to provide such services anymore. Everything has stopped. Actually, the damage that took place is widespread.
Al-Aqsa University of Gaza, which is affiliated with the Fatah Party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, was also partially damaged during the war. Ahmed Abu Aisha is a student of math.
This, of course, is part of a systematic, deliberate series of destruction by the Israeli establishment. Along with the destruction of Palestinian trees and infrastructure, this establishment intends to destroy the Palestinian educational system in order to render the Palestinian community illiterate.
The Israeli blockade prevents many critical building materials from entering Gaza, including steel, cement, iron, wood, and aluminium. In an effort to repair Gaza without these materials, the governing Hamas party attempted to build a makeshift housing system out of clay. But these attempts have so far failed due to technical reasons. Youssef Al-Mansi is a Minister of Works and Construction in Gaza. Afasaran asked him what makes the reconstruction process difficult.
It is unnecessary that we get cash in our hands. What is needed is that the reconstruction begins so that people can be housed again. We have extended offers to contractors, companies, institutions, and countries to come and implement the reconstruction in coordination with us. For those who want to reconstruct, there are many clear means for them to start reconstruction. But we reject any political extortion. In the last war, we lost our children, our families, and our homes. But we still have our dignity.
Key international donors, including the US and European countries, have refused to recognize Hamas since the party came to power in 2006. The countries that pledged reconstruction funds are demanding Hamas recognize Israel, renounce violence, and accept past signed peace agreements with Israel before aid is sent to Gaza. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that wraps it up. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.